This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome, Place to Be Nation, readers, listeners, whatever you may be. This is the Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast. Now, this is the first time we've ever done this. It's a fifth-week event. Every fifth week, we do the wonderful, amazing, incomparable, giant size Hard Traveling Fanboys, or, as a certain friend of ours calls it, the giant, rock-hard, throbbing Hard Fanboys of Doom.
Oh, and, my.
Giant size.
That's correct. And with me, me being Greg Phillips in this case, is the wonderful Nick Duke, as always, my fellow Hard Traveling Fanboy.
Hi, guys. Looking forward to it. New format for us, but should be pretty cool.
Yes, yes. And once again, I'd like to remind you that this podcast can be found on iTunes. It is a Place to Be Network podcast. But, you know, as always, with the giant size columns that we do, we like to involve the rest of the staff here at the Place to Be Nation comics department here. So with us, we've got Place to Be Nation comics founder, the legendary Todd Weber. How are you, sir?
Gentlemen, I'm here with my psychic knife, which is the focused totality of my telepathic abilities.
Any Psylocke reference is a good reference, in my opinion. And what are you planning on doing with the psychic knife? Perhaps changing bodies at any point?
Yeah, I'm going to use it, and then I'll mysteriously wake up as an Asian woman. I don't understand.
Make yourself more sexy, Todd.
That happened to Nick last weekend, actually. It was strange.
Oh, sorry I missed it.
Yeah.
We're also joined by Tim Capel, master of the fill-in files and various other writings for Place to Be Nation. Place to Be Network, Nation, whatever. How are you doing, Tim?
I'm great. As a matter of fact, I'm non-vulnerable when I'm blasting. And I'm blasting.
And as always, the extremely active, the workaholic, Russell Sellers, comicaholic, everything-aholic, except alcoholic, Russell Sellers, how are you, sir?
Working on that last one as we speak. Definitely getting my comics fixed today since it was a nice, you know, since we're recording this on Memorial Day, had the day off and said, you know what, I've got this gigantic stack of comics, so you know what, it's time to break out some beer and get into this thing. And it's been quite a ride so far.
Absolutely. I can relate. I had the same experience over the weekend trying to catch up. But the point of this podcast, we always try to focus in on one topic for giant size, whether it be the death of Superman, which you can check out on the website, placetobenation.com, or whether it be one of our other wonderful columns that we've written in the past. We like to focus in on a topic and sort of just kind of go back and forth on it and pass around some different ideas. Well, this podcast, if you've listened to any of our other comics podcasts, they're usually a little bit, you know, we go way off format, but we usually have at least an idea as to where we're going. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this time we have no idea where we're going. We have a topic, and we're just going to shoot it back and forth and kind of see what comes up. And the topic is event books. And for those who aren't hardcore comic fans, event books are have kind of become the norm in comics, usually a big summer event, but oftentimes just a constant cycle of them. They're these basically giant crossovers where all the characters interact and it affects the entire superhero universe, whether it be DC or Marvel or even Image. And you know, there have been plenty of examples of this, and hopefully I'm describing the idea properly. These are event books we're talking about. We'll also talk about some crossovers that were limited to individual titles. For instance, stuff that might have only taken place in Green Lantern or X-Men, but involved a great number of characters from different books. Nick, anything to add to that?
No, that sounds about right. I mean, you know, I'm especially interested to get the take of Todd and Tim. These guys have been around comics a little bit longer than than I have, for sure. And I'm interested to hear about the early days of events, you know, how we got from pretty much just Crisis on Infinite Earth and Secret Wars to having two or three events every single year.
Yeah, and that's actually as good a place to start as any, because I was really interested in kind of going back to the genesis of sort of these big events. And I guess crossovers had been around for, you know, since the Golden Age, really. Things like the All-Star Squadron, things like that, and of course going into the Crisis on Multiple Earths stories that they did back in the 60s. But I guess all this kind of started, the idea of the event book kind of started coming together in the early 80s. Todd, Tim, either one of you want to take this as to far as your memories of the early event books are?
Well, I'll go ahead and start. I have fond memories of just reading through random Marvel books such as Amazing Spider-Man or Avengers or Fantastic Four or Uncanny X-Men, and seeing the team approach this mysterious monolith thick wall in Central Park where they disappeared, and then all of a sudden the next issue they showed up again. And what happened in the interim was known as the Marvel Superheroes Secret Wars, where the Beyonder had teleported them all to this arena planet. And I know actually there was this event called the Contest of Champions. I don't know if you guys remember that. That was kind of like a trial run for the Crisis, the Secret Wars, where they Marvel did an event where they compared superheroes with similar powers, and they had, you know, kind of Olympic style contests. It was not great, but
yeah, that was actually their first limited series. Mm-hmm. Mark Gruenwald wrote it, and I think it had art by early John Romita Jr. before he developed the signature style that we know so well, which I actually kind of dig the early John Romita Jr. But yeah, Contest of Champions came first. It was just three-issue limited series. I did not read it when it came out. In fact, I was not alive when it was originally published. It was, I think, 1982, so I read it at some point in the 90s. I don't remember when. Was not great, but as you said, definitely a trial run. The high concept there was just simply one of the so-called elders of the universe in the Marvel universe, the Grandmaster wants to bring his BFF, the Collector, back from the dead. He had died in the Korvac saga earlier, which was a major Avenger storyline at the time. If you guys haven't read the Korvac saga, I highly recommend it. It's really good. Jim Shooter writing, George Perez and various others on art, one of those classic storylines that actually seems to hold up pretty well. But anyway, Collector's dead, Grandmaster wants him alive again, has this wager with Death, who is another abstract concept, who is a cosmic being, elder of the universe.
There are a lot of these in the Marvel Universe.
There are a lot of these, and a lot of them were contributions from Mark Gruenwald, the late great Mark Gruenwald. And so they sit down and they assemble various different teams, and basically, if the Grandmaster wins, his BFF, the Collector, is resurrected. The Collector will be brought to life by Benicio del Toro in Guardians of the Galaxy later this summer. He's the character who has been described as like this cosmic Liberace. So if you've seen any stills from that film or of Benicio del Toro done up as that character, you kind of know what you're in store for. It's kind of a cool take on that concept. But anyway, they have their teams and they fight it out, and you know, it brings in various international superheroes that we've never seen before who are introduced for the first time. So you have great character finds like Defensor of Argentina, La Peregrine of France, Shamrock of Ireland, Talisman of Australia, and various other terrible stereotypes and national cliches. So, I mean, it was what it was. Not a whole lot came of these new characters, but the thing about Contest of Champions that was kind of interesting, it was an early sort of prototype of the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, which was another Mark Gruenwald production which was you know, one of those synopses of all the various characters in the Marvel Universe who had appeared up to that point, their background, their powers, just one of those great resources. Contest of Champions had very, very brief profiles of all the characters who were featured in this limited series. So, you know, it was just a precursor to Grunewald's baby in the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. But anyway, I've totally preempted Todd here, but
that's okay.
That's kind of all I wanted to say about Contest of Champions. And
let me ask you this. Did the heroes actually fight each other? Because the title makes me think that they were put in, like, Olympic Games-style competitions, like the 400-meter dash and, you know, the javelin throw or something.
Well, they didn't compete in, like, the summer, you know, Olympic Games or anything, but yeah, they did fight each other. It was one of those superheroes fighting each other.
Gosh, and they didn't have any foot races then, or
I don't recall any foot races. Uh-huh. I could be wrong.
I feel like there's a missed opportunity there, you know, to see, like, powerlifting by the superheroes or whatever, you know.
Well, the subtitle of that series could have been missed opportunities. So, you know, I feel you.
So how do we go from Contest of Champions to Secret Wars? How did that happen, Todd?
I believe Marvel entered into a semi-lucrative toy deal with Mattel.
As all great ideas come
from. Yep, that's exactly right.
And so, you know, they collected this, all their A-listers, Iron Man, the Avengers, Fantastic Four, the X-Men, and a couple scattered solo heroes, and put them all on this battle planet where they kind of, it's like a Lord of the Flies situation. Everybody's kind of fending for themselves against Beyonder. You've got the good guys, and you also have the villains, too. You had Doctor Doom and a lot of kind of miscellaneous Thor villains. You had the Wrecking Crew from Thor. You did have Dr. Octopus.
Ultron, kind of, Claw, yeah. Those guys.
Yeah, Claw was kind of freaky in this series. He freaked me out quite a bit, especially the Mike Zeck art. It was kind of scary. And you didn't have Claw's archenemy, the Black Panther, in there. But,
I know.
It was neat. I liked the getting introduced to these new characters like Molecule Man, who's super duper powerful, and you had the new Spider-Woman in there. You had, of course, the origins of Spider-Man's new costume came from there. You had Colossus cheating on Kitty Pryde with a strange alien girl, so that was a big thing. Colossus was kind of my avatar back then. I you know, I am Russian guy. I am big. I am strong.
And
he's sensitive, but he cheated on Kitty. I did not want for this to happen. I did not mean for this to happen, Tovarish. Katya. Anyway,
well,
so
that
just,
led
you
to
hit
it, right?
Every. You just hit all of Peter's lines. Katya. Moi.
There it is. It's the other one.
Moi. Well, it led to a great follow-up in Uncanny X-Men.
The Brawl.
Which at the time was written by Claremont and, once again, J.R. Jr. on art. The bar in the bar where Wolverine pretty much calls out Colossus. He was like, you know, you really fucked this up, didn't you? And he was like, yeah. And the whole time, the whole time, you know, Wolverine knows that Juggernaut is over here sitting in the corner just getting lit. And picks a fight with Colossus, who, like, spills a beer on him, I think. And, you know, Juggernaut throws down with him, and they completely wrecked the place. I guess it was, what was the bar they always went to? Was it Harry's Hideaway? That bar that Claremont always put the characters in, and outside of Westchester. Anyhow, they had this great, you know, barroom brawl. Colossus gets his ass whooped, and Wolverine's like, well, you know, you had it coming. So that was sort of his comeuppance after that.
Wolverine at his most sensitive.
Exactly. Let his teammate get his ass whipped by Juggernaut. And Colossus was like, yeah, I know, I kind of deserved it. So just more of that great character development from Claremont, which was more soap opera than superheroics back in the day.
So is it fair to say that the biggest lingering impact from Secret Wars was the Spider-Man suit, which of course led to Venom and so many other things after that?
I think that is safe to say. I think I was really excited about maybe seeing Doctor Doom's face, and that didn't happen. When I was a 10-year-old kid, that was a monumental thing, and of course it didn't happen. He looked very handsome. We didn't see the actual.
They cheated. Face. Yeah, they cheated, didn't they?
Switcheroo. But yeah, the legacy of it is that we did get the symbiote. I can't even say it. Symbiote. I can't say it. We got the costume. Yeah, thank you. My son thinks I'm talking about the Lion King. Yeah. No. hey, which led to Web of Spider-Man number one. The costume turns evil, and Spidey uses the church bell sonics to get it off, and then the costume finds journalist Eddie Brock, and he becomes Venom, and we have a whole new marketable character, a new property for Marvel, as it were.
Which, of course, leads once again to the mother of all of these events, money. A lot of money for Marvel.
Todd, did you get the impression that was kind of the plan for that black suit from the get-go, or was that something that you think just kind of got kind of tacked on after the fact?
I think it was tacked on after the fact. I think were the black suit to be insanely popular and people wanting those figures, and you know, it was very cool art style. You had the classic, not classic, I know somebody there hates Tom DeFalco, but the Tom DeFalco Spider-Man era there had the black suit, and it was used also in Peter Parker's Spectacular Spider-Man too, but it didn't really catch on at the time. I liked it at first, but then people were kind of, no, get me back the classic red and blue. So, well, I think it was more marketable.
As the legend goes,
heel turn.
Yeah, well, as the legend goes, they wanted to change Spider-Man's costume. It was just going to be a temporary gimmick type of thing to tie into Secret Wars. And Jim Shooter, Marvel's editor-in-chief at the time, who himself is a pretty divisive, controversial figure, supposedly he purchased this design from a fan who just said, hey, here's a riff I did on, you know, Spider-Man's costume. And it was a little bit different. It was the black suit, but instead of the white highlights, it had, like, red instead, I believe. Anyway, you can Google, like, early
so more Wolfpack original. Than, more Wolfpack than Hollywood.
More Wolfpack than Hollywood, for sure.
Yeah.
Arriba La Raza, my friends.
Very much so. So that's what Jim Shooter was thinking.
Simba, there we go.
So, Shooter didn't want to actually hire this guy to freelance or write or draw for them, but he liked the design enough that he was willing to purchase it. And so they bought it outright, and that's how the black costume came about. It was adjusted a little bit to what we eventually saw on the published page. And it's funny because, like Todd said, you had, as a cliffhanger, all of these characters disappear into this citadel, this fortress in, I guess, Central Park. And the very next issue, they emerge and, in a lot of cases, are completely changed. And, you know, there was only, you know, a month between issues, but Secret Wars, the entire 12-issue series, so that's a year's worth of publication, occurs between, you know, two issues, essentially, in Marvel's publishing calendar. So the black costume debuted in Spider-Man, his monthly series, Amazing Spider-Man, before it actually showed up in Secret Wars, when we learned what the origin of this new suit was. And so, that was in the Tom DeFalco era. He was writing the series. I guess it was after Roger Stern, who had a pretty celebrated run. Ron Frenz on art.
That's it. Ron Frenz, that was the name I couldn't come up with.
Okay, yeah. Ron Frenz.
One of my favorite Spider artists, to be honest.
Yeah, he's really good. Sort of followed in the house style of, I guess, John Romita Sr., but put his own spin on that. It's kind of in the same way that I think of Mark Bagley and following on Todd McFarlane's heels.
Yes, and definitely.
I kind of like Bagley better, to be honest with you, but anyhow, that's another conversation. But, you know, the black costume proved to be really popular and caught on, and even after he shed the alien symbiote, he continued to wear a black costume, just that's a regular... True. Yeah, it was just a regular, I guess, you know, your unstable molecules, whatever the superhero's costumes are made out of. But it was a normal costume. It was no longer a living alien being, but it was that same black costume that he continued to wear because it was so popular. And for a while, he would alternate between the two, his classic red and blue and the black suit. Of course, the alien symbiote continued to live on and would later bond to Eddie Brock, like you said, Todd, in the late 80s. So, yeah, I mean...
So somewhere there's some poor fan that was stupid enough to sell his idea one time only to Jim Shooter and never got any of the royalties off of Venom in the 90s. Crazy.
I've heard it was for as much as $1,000, but I've also... Urban legend would lead you to believe it was as little as $100 he sold that for, but it was not a huge chunk of change. It was like, you know, a month's rent, essentially.
Well, so Secret Wars is going on at Marvel. At the same time, what's going on over at DC? And we had obviously Crisis on Infinite Earths is one of those books that holds up over time, but is it something that was already going on, or is it something that happened because Secret Wars was successful?
Well, that's a great question. I think editorially they'd been kind of thinking about how to simplify the DC universe, the multiverse, for a long time. Like, why do we have two, okay, well, maybe three, you know? We've got an infinite number of Supermen. And they wanted to streamline their books to make them a little more user-friendly. And DC, we talked about this, DC kind of resets everything every 30 years, going back to the Silver Age. You know, we have all these trademarks, but we're going to take them and take the old Green Lantern, take the old Flash, and we'll reintroduce some sci-fi-based versions of those. And this is kind of the next generation, the next step of that, where they take the multiple versions of characters and they streamline them. So no longer did you have a World War II occurring Superman. You had Superman who was set in 1986. He just arrived on Krypton. And was being debuted into the universe post-Crisis. You had a reboot of Wonder Woman. You had kind of a simplification of Batman's origins. You didn't have two Batman, one who was the Huntress's father and married to Catwoman. You had just the one classic post-Neil Adams, Bruce Wayne Batman, where he was darker and grim and gritty. It wasn't the happy-go-lucky Dick Sprang.
Eyebrows on the bat, the cowl.
Ace the Bat Hound. So everything was being streamlined and simplified with the Crisis on Infinite Earths, which was not a ploy to sell toys. It was a ploy to make the universe streamlined and more simplified for the new reader who wasn't really. I don't remember anybody saying this is confusing. I thought it was kind of cool that you had this story that kept Earth 2, which was really Earth 1 because it was the first one, if we're talking about it that way. You know, you have this history. You have Superman in the Golden Age, and you have Superman, a contemporary Superman, and you could have them cross over, and, you know, maybe a couple generations down the line, you'd introduce a brand new Earth that you could tell brand new stories, which is kind of what's going on right now. The difference being Crisis left reset continuity all the way. You had stories that had happened in the past, but all of a sudden, like the Barry Allen had this complete career, but as far as the end of the Crisis, Barry Allen, it had always been that way. Barry Allen had always been dying in the Crisis and existing in the Justice League. So you had a lot of stories that were cleaned up and made easy to understand, but you had to totally redo your history. You had to have, well, that's not how the Justice League happened. Superman wasn't there at the beginning of the Justice League. Superman, you know, came later. You had this core, you had a lot of new problems that were created by this so-called simplified continuity. But Crisis, the event itself was wonderful. It tied into so many of the DC line. all the way from books like Amethyst and The Warlord to the more mainstream things of my favorite books at the time, Teen Titans, Justice League, and Firestorm, The Nuclear Man. So, yeah, Crisis is probably my favorite vintage company-wide crossover event book, especially because of the good dialogue by Marv Wolfman, and I did like the imagery of characters like the Anti-Monitor and Pariah. It was very cool. And, of course, you can forget the iconic covers of...
Oh, the wonderful covers.
Superman holding the dead Supergirl. You had the Final Fate of the Flash. You had the amazing cover of issue 12, where just pretty much every character in continuity, old or new, was all there. So I can't talk enough about Crisis. I have a couple different versions of it. I have all the original issues. I have a trade paperback, and then I don't have the absolute one, but I do have a limited signed slipcased Crisis, signed by everybody involved, Giordano before he died, Wolfman, Perez, and Alex Ross, who did some cover art for that too. So Alex Ross gets his name involved with anything, even years after the fact. So, yeah.
And Todd, you mentioned like how much it tied into other books. You know, the first couple times I read it, you know, I came to it years after, and the first time I read it was a completely different experience from the second time I read it, because I think the first time I read it, I was very new to DC continuity and kind of just starting to become, you know, a DC fanboy essentially, and I was completely lost. There were so many characters that I had no clue who they were, what their motivations were, and then I retried it a few years later, and it was like night and day in terms of difference. Was it difficult at the time for you or anybody else to follow? I mean, because it involves so many different characters that maybe you weren't following on a month-to-month basis?
Well, I believe, you know, I'm not sure who the editor was. Maybe it was Len Wein. I believe that might be it. But in the notes for Crisis, he said, "You may be lost. Therefore, we are publishing simultaneously who's who in the DC universe," which was a lot like the official handbook of the Marvel universe that Grunewald had done over there at Marvel, but this had not just a baseball card kind of look. It had improved artwork where you had the character in several action poses or done by different artists, usually associated with the characters. Who's Who is really awesome. So I read that at about the same time. So as I'm learning about these characters and following them in the Crisis, I'm also reading their history in Who's Who, which is awesome. I have every issue of the original and then all the sequels that came with it. I even had the binder Who's Who that came out in the early 90s, a loose leaf, which is very cool too.
Did it feel – it sounds – you know, obviously I read it in hindsight the same way that Nick did, but it seems like they kind of went out of their way to kind of help people understand what was going on at the time, like you said, with the Who's Who, which is something that I think that a lot of times companies haven't done a great job of with some of these big events in modern times. Did you feel that things like that really helped to keep up with what was going on and keep up with changes that were made or characters that were introduced, things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you had, as each issue of the Crisis progressed and you introduced new characters from different worlds, and, okay, here's the quality characters, here's the Shazam characters, you could just kind of see that the dialogue and the exposition was written in such a way you got to see that this is, okay, we can definitely tell what characters are who. And, you know, we read comics a lot differently nowadays.
Yeah, this was when they folded in, like, Blue Beetle and...
Uh-huh.
And
Charlton Heroes. Yep.
The Charlton Heroes, Captain Atom, all those guys got folded into the DC Universe proper, which... that was kind of a nice way to kill two birds with one stone. While you're killing all these multiverses, you're bringing in these characters that you have the publication rights to and sort of setting them up, introducing them to readers, and saying, hey, you know, the new landscape of the DC Universe, you should familiarize yourself with these guys because they're going to be sticking around.
Yeah, one of the things you see a lot online, and I agree with it, is that Crisis kind of set a template that most of these other event books since then have tried to aspire to in terms of tying, especially the universe-wide "this changes everything" event, in terms of trying to manage a bunch of different threads, a bunch of different characters, having emotional beats in the midst of keeping the action going, because I always felt like Crisis was very action-packed. But even in, amid all these amazing action shots from George Perez, you also had the wonderful emotion of Supergirl's death and Flash's death and the sacrifice from Alexander Luthor and Prime and Superboy Prime and the Superman and Lois of Earth 2. And also the art, obviously. George Perez kind of set the standard for how you draw thousands of characters on a single page. Did you guys find that to be the case, that a lot of the events that came past have still tried to kind of use that as a template for how the right way to tell a huge universe spanning story?
Yeah, I agree with that. And you also had the early introduction of, for more on this, little editor's note on the bottom, to be continued in a book that you wouldn't necessarily collect, to be included, to be followed up on in Infinity Incorporated or something, And so that happens to this day where, you're kind of encouraged to go out and read books that you wouldn't normally go if you want the entire story.
I guess that's kind of weird because, I never read comics at a time where that wasn't in there because, that was so huge to me when I was a kid, seeing, check out Action Comics number whatever if you want to see where Superman first encountered Silver Banshee or whatever. And I'd be like, okay, I'm going to go to the back issue bin and find that issue.
Supposedly the writers on the regular series of the titles that tied into Crisis on Infinite Earths, initially they didn't want to have anything to do with this crossover. They just thought it was a gimmick. It was just going to blow over, and it might change the landscape of the universe, but they weren't going to interrupt their own plans, whatever they were going to do to, conclude their runs on these various different titles. But when they saw how it was selling, it was like, oh, let's get on board with that. So that's when you had all of these series all at once deciding, we're going to do a tie-in here. And that's where you got the term, what is it, Red Skies crossover, mm-hmm. where, it's like it might be as inconsequential as somebody looking up and seeing, oh, that's weird, the sky is red all of a sudden because of, what the Anti-Monitor is doing, and it's a reference to Crisis, but that's essentially where the crossover ends. It's just, it has no bearing whatsoever on the events of that series, but it's reminding you, hey, this is what's going on, and we're a part of that, even tangentially like this.
Yeah, Russell came into DC around, I guess, 2005, 2006, somewhere around there, when I was lending you some books at the time, I think, and you subsequently got huge into it. When did you first come across Crisis, and what were you yourself lost at all, or did you find yourself kind of immersed in it?
What really helped with me was having actually read a lot of those books that I borrowed from you, Greg, because I remember reading Green Lantern Rebirth and the first couple volumes of Superman Batman from Jeff Loeb, and that really got me familiar with the characters and with a lot of the concepts that I was probably going to be seeing once I finally decided to go back and read some of those older events. And I picked up Crisis probably 2007, maybe. It was shortly after I'd read Infinite Crisis for the first time. And
that's actually when I read it for I had heard about it for years, but I read about it after reading Infinite Crisis.
Yeah, so after reading that and kind of brushing up on some Wikipedia articles, because I was thinking, man, if I'm going to travel this far back to a time of the DC universe that I'm definitely not going to be familiar with, I decided to kind of brush up on things that I could find online. And once I started reading it, I was struck by how many similarities it really did have with similarities Infinite Crisis has with it. And you can tell that Geoff Johns was definitely influenced by everything that had gone on in the original Crisis, and he really did write kind of a true sequel to it. But there was some stuff in there, especially with the Charlton characters, with some of the other Earths that hadn't been explored, especially the stuff towards the beginning of Crisis that I wasn't really familiar with. It was a little confusing, but as things went along, I just kind of started rolling with it. And as it progressed, it all just kind of coalesced, and I was able to follow along pretty easily for the most part. to this day, I've read it a couple more times since, and it really does seem to be one of those stories that gets better with age. The more times you go through it, the more sense it starts to make, and then it actually was, I think, a more emotional read for me the second time through.
I agree, because I had more of a connection to certainly Barry Allen the second time I read it than I did the first time I read it, also Supergirl as well, and seeing some of these classic scenes that have kind of been gone back to, you know, the death of Barry Allen is one of the most influential deaths in comics. It really shaped the DCU from that point forward. And I don't want to turn this into the Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast or anything, so let's move on to the rest of the 80s and some of the events that followed Secret Wars and Crisis. I believe you had a direct sequel to Secret Wars. How did that come about?
Secret Wars 2, yes. I'm not sure exactly. I'm not sure exactly how it came about, but I know that Secret Wars 1 was, you know, like Todd explained, it was the genesis of this marketing deal between Marvel and Mattel, who were developing action figures, and they were sort of hedging their bets. They weren't really sure if these were going to be a hit. It was kind of counter-programming to Kenner, who had introduced the Superpowers collection, if you remember those early DC action figures, which, you know, it was the first time guys like Martian Manhunter and Firestorm and, you know, even Lex Luthor and, you know, the contemporary characters of the 1980s pre-crisis DC universe got traditional action figures in the Superpowers collection. Well, you know, Secret Wars was Mattel's response to that, and they wanted a big publishing bonanza to coincide and get that corporate synergy going. And so that's how Secret Wars came about. Jim Shooter decided that he was the only person qualified to write Secret Wars, which was a nice little coup on his part. The way he justified it was he wanted to eliminate or preemptively get away from any sort of squabbling between creators who, you know, the legendary feuds between Chris Claremont and John Byrne, Peter David and John Byrne, and just about anyone in John Byrne, to be honest with you, but
that's what I think about it. Course.
Right? So, you know, this massive publishing event, which was going to feature every character from every different editorial fiat within the Marvel Universe, he didn't want to deal with any kind of writers squabbling between each other saying, hey, you took my character and completely undermined the story that I'm telling or the development that's taken place up to this point, this, that, and the other. He just said, screw all that. I'll write it. You guys sit off to the sidelines, do your own thing, and I will oversee this. Well, you know, that was a nice little, you know, feather in his hat, because he got all the, you know, licensing revenues and everything as a result of being the sole writer on the project. So I'm guessing that Secret Wars 2 was kind of the same idea. The original Secret Wars being such a success, he said, well, let me follow it up with a sequel, and, you know, I will collect dividends from that too. And, you know, say what you will about Jim Shooter, but he was a pretty shrewd businessman and had some good marketing savvy at a time when marketing was not what it would morph into in the comics industry in subsequent decades. So Secret Wars 2, it was, you know, the spine of it was a 9-issue limited series. It had a ton of tie-ins. I guess just like we saw in Crisis, you know, once the sales figures rolled in, everybody wanted a piece of this. So pretty much every regular series that Marvel was publishing at the time, in some form or another, crossed over into Secret Wars 2. But the problem was,
It's been remembered and is regarded today as a complete and utter turd buster. I've read it myself. I mean, it's not the worst thing in the world, but it's pretty terrible. I mean, it's hard to believe that, you know, Marvel put that much effort behind this and, you know,
and thought that this... This was at a time when Marvel was riding pretty high creatively, correct?
Yeah, this was during, I believe, the Walt Simonson Thor run. I'm not sure if Frank Miller's Born Again had taken place yet or not, but it was in that time frame, 1985, 86-ish. I think 85 was when Secret Wars ultimately concluded. You still had... Claremont riding high on X-Men, John Byrne on Fantastic Four, that might have concluded by this point, but on the whole, yeah, kind of a creative peak for Marvel. That 1985-86 period is sort of a creative renaissance for comics as a whole, which was pretty much defined by the big two, but yeah, you had a lot of really... iconic runs that can be traced back to this particular period.
And then right in the middle of that, you have a giant steaming turd named Secret Wars 2.
You do. but you got to keep in mind that Marvel was experimenting with a lot of different things. It was shortly after this that you'd get the debut of the new universe. I don't know that it's appropriate to talk about that in the context of big events because... It was a completely different animal entirely. It was a failed experiment, but an interesting experiment nonetheless. But, you know, Secret Wars 2 brought us gems like the Beyonder taking human form, and he's got, like, this
shoulder
kind
pads.
Of very dated, yeah. The,
80s shoulder pads, wonderful.
This very dated look, and he is... he meets Spider-Man, and Spider-Man, like, teaches him how to use the bathroom because he doesn't understand that that's a part of human life, and it's an everyday occurrence that you have to take care of, and, I mean, it's just really, I don't know,
Sandra
like...
Sandra is actually writing a movie about that right now as we speak.
It's really in the wheelhouse of 2000s Adam Sandler, for sure. But the funny thing is that this humanoid form of the Beyonder, he's sort of in the mold of every Jim Shooter cosmic creation, which is like this kind of omniscient, you know, cosmic being, all powerful, who has their heart in the right place, if only everyone else around him would get on board and get with the program and understand what he's trying to do. And it's sort of like, you know, almost in the mold of Jim Shooter himself. You can go back to Michael Korvac in the Korvac saga, who is this misunderstood cosmic entity who just wants to get along and, you know, has the right idea and is going to set humanity on the right path if he would just be let alone. You know, he has everyone's best intentions in mind. And you saw that again with the Molecule Man in Secret Wars 1. Here we go again with the Beyonder. So this was very quintessential Jim Shooter. And I'm not the first person to make this observation. You know, I'm not casting aspersions on Jim Shooter at all. I got a lot of respect for the guy, but creatively, he went to this well a lot.
Todd, what are your creative memories of Secret Wars 2, like from a quality standpoint?
Two words: shit sandwich.
That bad, eh?
It was so bad. I bought it at the time, at least the first couple issues I remember, thinking, okay, great. Secret Wars 1 was very cool and kind of self-contained. If you think about just the actual core of the story, the story told within those 12 issues was awesome, even though it did expand and tie into the expanded universe of the Marvel U. But Secret Wars 2 brought the Beyonder to Earth and had him take a tour of the Marvel universe, so to speak, and then he interacted with all these different teams and all these different aspects of the Marvel U. It was boring. It was flat. I didn't relate to anything, and the art was stiff and kind of, compared to the awesome Mike Zeck fight scenes of Secret Wars 1, Secret Wars 2 was just kind of fell very flat, very stiff, and Beyonder wasn't even a likable heel. He had X-Pac heat, if you know what I mean.
I don't even remember who did the art. I don't remember well, that's why I don't remember then, yeah. Because he is about the most least consummate professional, but kind of the most least memorable artist in all of comics, just about very just house style Marvel, yep. 80s.
Is there anything worse than a boring event book?
It really is boring. I don't even remember what the conflict of this was. I don't remember how it concluded. I mean, I remember the little, like I said, the little specific character beats, like, you know, Spider-Man teaching the Beyonder how to take a shit or, you know, piss or whatever he did, but that's literally all I can even remember about this.
This
thing.
Is how you take a duty.
That's a bad sign.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, you know, you mentioned, is there anything worse than a boring event book? Has the standard for boring kind of changed over the years? Because I would imagine back in the 80s, you know, just having the characters all together on the same page was a big deal. And so even if they were doing something as, you know, mundane as teaching each other how to take dumps, it might still be, like, you know, somewhat interesting to somebody. But nowadays, like, I think the event has become so common that there you have to bring a little bit more to the table than just, hey, here's these characters on the same page.
Well, that's the thing, Todd. Did they even really bring all the characters together in Secret Wars 2? It was just a bunch of collected little anecdotes that didn't amount to anything. It was.
I gotta be honest. I had Secret Wars 2 downloaded as part of my my Great Thor chronology read I did last year, and I read the first issue and skipped the rest. And I don't even remember. It's not even because it was bad. I honestly just don't remember anything about it.
Instantly forgot what happened.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, let me put it this way. It had stuff like, it was the Beyonder doing little experiments with humanity. So there was one where he gave, like, Rachel Summers unlimited power, okay? The talk about Days of Future Past, the time-displaced daughter of Cyclops and Jean Grey, and I've already probably lost half of our listeners by mentioning this. Yeah, I mean, goddamn, right? So it was stuff like that where she would go on to reshape the world, but then they press the cosmic reset button and everyone goes on and lives their lives, but it's a little nice nugget of character development for her personally, but ultimately is lost in the waves of time. And, you know, they killed, like, all the New Mutants and brought them back to life instantaneously, and they're like, holy shit, we just died. And that's some character development for them, but ultimately doesn't amount to anything because this entire event is just a blip on the radar. So it's stuff like that where it's very inconsequential, and it's supposed to have these little character beats that are going to go on and have some meaning in the longer term, but, you know, it was just a very frivolous tie-in to this event miniseries that no one was interested in, that was terribly boring, so as a reader you forget about it and you disregard it, you know, whether you're reading it at the time or you're looking back on it 20 years later.
Well, before we take a break, we're still on the 80s. Let's pinball around some of the other memorable events of the 80s, crossover events of the 80s, you know, whether they be good or bad. Like, for one that comes to my mind as being incredibly bad is Millennium. From DC Comics, just one of the strangest events, I think I feel safe in saying, that has ever occurred. It involved a new race of Guardians, I believe, and a, just it seemingly involved every single book in the DCU. The first comic I ever read was actually, I believe, a tie-in to Millennium, which was a Superman issue towards the end of John Byrne's run. And this created a new race of characters and someone who I can't remember the precise specifics of it, but I believe a character who snorted cocaine to gain powers or something like that, and a very strange event. Anyone remember Millennium at all?
Yeah, Millennium was crazy. It was deep down a kind of a Green Lantern thing where you had the Oa Guardians had this previous peacekeeping force called the Manhunters.
Yeah.
And they had these sleeper Manhunters and sleeper agents that had been set up on Earth. And you had, with Millennium, you had all these, each book, the promise was that there was one spy in each series. So Wally West's dad turned out to be a Manhunter agent. Am I remembering this right?
That's right. Yeah. I actually have that comic and read it recently.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't the Guardians leave the this universe or whatever because they wanted to go bone with the Zamorons?
They
want
to go have
The deal? Like they were going to go procreate for like the rest of eternity, essentially, right?
Have you seen the Guardians and have you seen the Zamorons?
Yeah, like really. I mean, they're trading up. They're my heroes. I mean,
they never mind.
Greg,
the character you're thinking of, I think, is Snowflame.
Yes.
And
yes.
Give us
a Tim Capel explanation of Snowflame.
Well, I don't know if I can do that, but I can give you the following quote. All right. I am Snowflame. Every cell of my being burns with white-hot ecstasy. Cocaine is my god, and I am the human instrument of its will. This is a direct quote from Snowflame, the great character find of 1988, apparently.
And then, And then,
paraphernalia. We have, I'm looking at dc.wikia.com, all right, just to give credit where it's due. We have, and this is like for every character, it has like their history, their powers, their equipment, related appearances, stuff like that. So, all right, we have, all right, you guys ready for this? Powers and abilities, unique physiology. The more cocaine he used, the more powerful Snowflame became. Now, this would give him the properties of superhuman strength, superhuman speed, immunity to pain, pyrokinesis, that's kind of convenient, cocaine touch. What's cocaine touch? It sounds like a sounds like an 87 single for anyway.
It's touching the contact high.
Okay, yeah, touching Snowflame was sufficient to give the Floronic Man a contact high. So that gives you a bit of context. The Floronic Man,
he was like a pusher for the Floronic Man, kind of.
Okay, so there you go. His weaknesses include drug addiction, cocaine. That's all we have. Paraphernalia, equipment. Cocaine, believe it or not, is listed as his equipment.
His strength and his weakness.
His strength. It's such a vicious cycle, Russell.
Weaknesses, cocaine. Equipment, cocaine. Notes, Snowflame's religion is cocaine worship. I swear to God, I'm reading this.
Yeah, I'm looking at it too.
Snowflame's cartel tried to avenge his death in New Guardians number 3. So, he is from Columbia. Surprise.
So he was, you know, a ridiculous villain, obviously, but, like, the New Guardians themselves were pretty ridiculous. They have, like, Hal Jordan's little Eskimo friend, Tom Kalmaku, you know, Pie Face, you know, gain powers, and then, like, when they decided they didn't like it anymore, he just went back over to Green Lantern, and it was never addressed, the fact that he lost powers or had ever been a new guardian.
Never had powers.
Because, like, I did, you know, my big Green Lantern chronology run, and I mean, seriously, like, the next time he pops up in the Green Lantern solo series, it's not mentioned. It's just like, it never happened.
Hal's like, hey, Pie Face, where you been for the last year? Oh, nowhere.
Even though Hal, like, watched all this happen. And, you know, as laughably bad as the New Guardians and Millennium were, one thing it did give us, you know, and your mileage may vary on it, but there is a character, Extraño, who was, I believe, openly gay, and it was one of the first times that had happened in comics, you know, so that was, what, 88, 87, somewhere in that time
frame? Yeah, yeah.
So that, I mean, that's kind of a good thing, I guess, but that's really about all you can say about
Although,
it.
Although, I don't think that they handled him in exactly the most tactful way. I'm not sure how that played out exactly. I never read the New Guardians.
Yeah. His name translates to strange, so...
Yeah.
Almost sort of like you could call him queer, I guess. This motherfucker, Snowflame, was created by Steve Englehart.
Man.
Holy shit.
And Englehart did a lot of good things with the Green Lantern series, I can say. I mean,
he did a lot of good things in comics and comics as a whole, but wow. I think we could count Snowflame as a misfire. I guess they can't.
Maybe it was one of those things like he was creating a character that was a projection of himself at the time.
I tell you, man, that
like Jim Shear? Wow.
Possibly.
That Englehart run on Green Lantern where it was where it became Green Lantern Corps for a little while is probably my favorite Green Lantern, you know, run that it wasn't written by Geoff Johns. It's really outstanding. If anybody ever gets a chance to pick that up, it's really, really good.
Well, it's funny. We can talk about Green Lantern prior to Geoff Johns because it's interesting to me that that was sort of a franchise in its own right at one point where you had various different Green Lantern titles like Green Lantern Corps, Green Lantern Corps Quarterly. Yeah. I think Guy Gardner had a series. There was Green Lantern Mosaic. Yeah, Mosaic. With
when they did Action Comics Weekly, that became the home of Hal Jordan for a time. Mm-hmm. When he did the solo series. And then, of course, you know, you got Green Lantern and Green Arrow, which is still one of the, you know, most influential and iconic series in DC history, I would argue.
Sure, yeah. So it's funny, and that all kind of came to a head in another event I'm sure we'll talk about, Emerald Twilight, and that sort of boiled everything down to just one series. So people forget that Green Lantern was a franchise even before Geoff Johns came along, with you know, a whole lot of different series. And you know, when comics were riding high in the 90s and you could get a family of books, whether it was, you know, the Avengers books, the X books,
Superman,
Justice League, Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, Green Lantern had his own family of books and didn't last long, but you know, That's comics for you.
It didn't last long, but if you really go back and look at it, that Mosaic series, the Guy Gardner solo series, that Gerard Jones, I guess it was 50 issues before Emerald Twilight. Really, really good stuff.
Gerard Jones did some really great stuff on that character.
Absolutely, The you know, the white streak of hair that a lot of people make fun of. Actually, was kind of handled pretty well, and then Geoff Johns kind of took it and even, you know, made it even cooler and more interesting with the retcon he did on it.
I loved what he did with making Hal kind of the elder statesman superhero, which you didn't see a whole lot of. Every superhero had to be kind of in their late 20s, early 30s, that amorphous period where it would be sort of relatable to people no matter what age they are reading comics. Well, Hal was a little bit older.
Absolutely.
And it was like he was like a superhero going through a midlife crisis. Absolutely. Almost under Gerard Jones.
And you know, Jones also took John Stewart, who, I mean, John Stewart, don't get me wrong, love the character, very influential character in terms of introducing mainstream African American characters in the 70s, but for a long time he was just written as generic angry black man. And it wasn't until Gerard Jones came along that he finally started to flesh that character out. Yeah. Started to flesh that character out a lot, and the work, like I said, on that Mosaic series, and even Guy Gardner, who, he had been, you know, the cocky douche, and that was it. They even started to kind of try to redeem him a little bit between the Justice League series with his relationship with Ice, or whether it was in, you know, Guy Gardner Warrior or the Guy Gardner solo series, and, of course, who can forget the masterpiece that is A Guy and His Gnort.
That was truly one of the great works in American fiction. The only downside to that era of Hal is he always kind of vaguely looked like Dan Quayle, which was a little
awkward. Oh, wow. I never thought of that. He sure did. Who also did some really character-defining work on Gnort, you guys, was our good buddy Scott Lobdell over in...
when did he
over
write
in, he wrote Gnort and Gnort and Green Lantern Corps Quarterly, the series... Yeah. the quarterly series with Alan Scott, which was kind of my introduction to Green Lantern, to be honest with you. I really liked that series.
It was an interesting time with quarterly, and you guys may remember better than I do, but my remembrance of it is that you know, they had the Green Lantern thing going on in the Action Comics Weekly, and when that kind of ended, they wanted to go back to the solo series, but also give the you know, the side characters a little bit of a venue, and so they started quarterly as an opportunity to do Alan Scott stories and do backups with various Green Lanterns from throughout the core. At least that's my remembrance of it, I think.
That's exactly what it was, yeah.
All right, guys.
Yep.
Oh, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead, Tim.
No, that's all I wanted to say about Scott Lobdell and Gnort.
I wanted to add something about Scott, just as an aside. This week will be his final issue of Superman, and then we get to welcome Jeff Johns next month.
Thank God.
Praise the Lord.
On a related note, Nick Duke is actually going to add Superman to his pull list for the first time ever, I believe.
To be fair, I have Unchained this past year, so
that's true. Yes.
But yeah,
you'll still have Unchained for the next 2 years before it gets.
You know, strangely enough, Todd, I actually still have All-Star Batman and Robin on my pull, and I'm waiting for the next issue to come in that, and I just hadn't seen it yet, unfortunately.
Well, guys, before we leave the 80s for another break, real quick, want to get your favorite and least favorite event of the 80s. Todd Weber.
Okay, my favorite event of the 80s would probably be Crisis on Infinite Earths, seconded by Legends, which was a very cool John Ostrander, John Byrne series, and set up the Justice League Bwahaha era, but it was very serious in tone, but it featured a lot of my favorite characters, and I like that series quite a bit.
I still have not read crossovers. Can't wait.
It's pretty good. It's hard to find.
Yeah, I bought the single issues off eBay for an amount of money I'm not going to mention, and I have not yet read it, but I'm looking forward to it.
And I will have to say my least favorite would be gonna have to be Secret Wars 2, but some of the crazier X-Men things that were going on in the 80s before the 90s went totally excessive. I think, was Inferno still in the 80s, or is that?
Yes. Inferno was 89, yeah. And that's a good segue, because, not to preempt you,
no,
were you done, Todd?
Because I think I'm ambivalent about it. It was cool, but it was also, like, giving the X-Men a taste of things that I didn't like. I don't like my chocolate of X-Men mutants with
peanut
butter
of
Mephisto demons and Satan. So
wait. I have no clue what you're talking about. Explain.
All right.
Go, Tim.
Are you talking? All right. Inferno was 1989, an X-Men centered major event in the Marvel Universe. This was when all of the Madeline Pryor stuff came to a head. Okay? So Madeline Pryor was the first wife of Cyclops. And she was the spitting image of Jean Grey because, as originally planned, Chris Claremont apparently had not seen enough Alfred Hitchcock movies and thought that doing the exact duplicate double of a protagonist's love interest would be okay and not met with any resistance in serial storytelling North American comic books. So she looked just like Jean Grey. She was meant to be the happy ending for Cyclops to basically write him out of the series. That was Claremont's intention. Yeah. that was the intention there, all right? And I say that completely with objectivity, not with my Cyclops bias or any of that shit. We went down that road already. And Marvel, of course, is not going to let this go. Cyclops is a commercial property. He's not going to be allowed to go off into the sunset, so they drag him back into the picture. He goes on to, you know, found X-Factor with the original X-Men, leaves his wife and infant son, really upstanding, you know, great moment for that character.
And this what is a lot of people... Him.
This is my idol. Yeah, he's a great dude. This was before he was right, by the way. So
he was wrong.
He was wrong in this instance. I guess I can kind of concede that maybe people could look down on leaving your wife and infant son to hang out with your old buddies and your ex-girlfriend. Kind of doesn't speak well on your character, but, you know, comics.
But he can shoot optic blasts, come on.
He can shoot optic blasts, so, you know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So they drag him kicking and screaming back into the superhero fold. It was interesting because Claremont was like, hold on, this was done totally, he disavowed all of this development for the character. He was like, hold on, fuck this. You know, I tried
to.
With
good cause, probably.
What's that? Yeah, with good cause. He was like, I tried to give this guy a happy ending. You wouldn't let it happen. Trolling me hard, trolling me hard.
Yep.
So that was supposed to be the end of that character, except for maybe special occasions or crossovers or when he was needed, he might come out of retirement. And Claremont was like, wait, you can't do this. So his response to that was to bring Madeline back and to introduce her as a supporting cast member in X-Men, which he was writing at the time. Cyclops and his buddies are over in X-Factor. The two teams did not interact for a good 2 years up to Inferno, and it's pretty much Scott Summers, Cyclops, beating himself up in the pages of X-Factor, expressing an inexplicable inability to pick up the phone and call her. It's a lot of angst and him wondering, should I or shouldn't I? You know, I'm a total heel. I hope Madeline's okay. Let me call her. Oh, she's not there. I'm getting a busy signal. Oh, it's disconnected. Oh, well, let me go back to work. I mean, it was total bullshit stalling tactics to keep these teams separate, and it was really manufactured, and it really dogged especially the character of Cyclops and pretty much all of the original X-Men for years. Like, they all looked like total douchebags for the longest time. And so Inferno was sort of the attempt to put that right, but it was a little bit misguided because it did that by vilifying Madeline Pryor, Scott's estranged wife. So essentially she gets unlimited power by having this kind of fever dream where she meets some demon in Limbo, which is essentially hell in the Marvel Universe. It's a dimension which is the equivalent of hell in the Marvel Universe. So she's tempted by a demon, says, I'll give you the power to take revenge on your enemies and your ex-husband and all this shit. So she gets these mystical powers, thinks it was just a dream, but it wasn't really, and she ultimately is corrupted by this power, and she learns that she is the clone of Jean Grey. This was not Claremont's plan at all, but it had to be explained. Now that Jean is back from the dead, you have this woman who Cyclops is married to, looks just like Jean Grey. There has to be a logical explanation for this. So they decided that she was a clone created by Mr. Sinister, who, you know, is this arch villain. He was introduced, you know, about a year prior to this. Had this fixation on Cyclops and the Summers DNA and the bloodline, all this crap. And she was intended to be like this broodmare, essentially, where Jean Grey is dead, so next best thing, let's clone her, hook her up with Cyclops, they'll have a kid, and I can use this as an ultimate weapon against something, I'm not really sure yet. That was left pretty amorphous, and was explained through retcons after the fact, believe it or not. And it sort of holds up, but this didn't come about in the 80s in Inferno. That was just sort of an afterthought. So that was Madeline Pryor's backstory, and her motivation was to take revenge on her ex-husband. She's been corrupted by these demonic mystical forces, and now she has access to the powers that she genetically has inherited as a, I guess, clone of Jean Grey, plus, you know, whatever demonic abilities that were bestowed upon her, and a little bit of the Phoenix Force as well, which I'm not even going to get into how that came about because
that
we don't
have its own podcast.
That could be its own podcast. We ain't got time for that. But she had a little bit of cosmic abilities from the Phoenix Force too. So she tries to like sacrifice all these mutant babies to open this big portal to Limbo that's going to allow a bunch of demons to invade the mainstream Marvel universe. And it turns out to be the catalyst that causes X-Factor and the X-Men to meet for the first time. They have, of course, the superhero misunderstanding where they fight and fight and fight for a few issues. And I think the X-Men were like a little bit corrupted by their association with Madeline, and there was like some demonic possession going on because Chris Claremont was writing this stuff, and he has a little bit of a bondage fetish and a little bit of a mind control fetish. So that's just what you get with Chris Claremont. And, you know, this spilled over into other books that Marvel was putting out. It was primarily an X-Men event, but you saw some spillover into stuff like Avengers and Fantastic Four and I think Daredevil. Spider-Man had some. I believe this is where the Jason McIndale Hobgoblin took on his demonic appearance and was, you know, transformed and turned into like this monstrous, you know, character where he's not wearing a mask anymore. McIndale and the demon would get split, and that would give us Demo Goblin later on in the 90s. So you had some ramifications for this. I yes, know, right?
That was my reaction when I was a kid too, Russell.
My only remembrance of Demo Goblin is him pummeling the hell out of me on the old Maximum Carnage video game.
Oh, we can talk about that. So Inferno,
glory, as it were.
Inferno gave us that. So that was one of the lasting contributions of the series, and ultimately Madeline ended up dying. Spoiler alert, sorry.
Yeah, by the way, guys, we're going to be spoiling a lot of 20-year and 30-year-old events in this podcast, so
An hour in, you might want to take note. This is, putting you on notice.
If you skipped to this point in the podcast before listening to the rest, and you go back and listen to the rest later, we're going to totally spoil Crisis and all this other stuff, so.
Darn. So
you never know. We might pay this off and spoil Forever Evil.
So that was Inferno, 1989. The other big thing that came out of that was Colossus' sister, Ileana, Magic, who gained her powers, and she grew up in Limbo. Again, another story we'll try not to get into. Felt herself being gradually corrupted by these forces, and you know her soul is being given over to the different big bads who are a part of this this major event, and she becomes what's it called, the Dark Child, and uses her soul sword to seal the portal.
I'm going to assume that that's Dark Child with a Y because it was the late 80s and early 90s.
No, but you're close. It's not Dark Child with a Y. It's Dark Child with an E at the end of child.
Oh, gotcha. Right on.
Yeah, yeah. But very astute on your part.
When everything was extreme and British.
Right. Well, this was like very
extremely British.
Yeah,
this was
go.
Not so much extreme as it was British. This was like very faux British.
Yeah, and I think DC had like a what was the name of this character? Dark Child, correct?
No. Yeah, and then there was what was it in DC? Bloodwind had the
Blood
Y.
Bloodwind with a Y. Blood and Wild Child with a Y.
Wild Child. Yeah. So you
probably
get
lucky. Wildcats didn't wind up spelled with a Y.
Oh, it would have been if it had come out about 4 years later.
Well, it did have cats as an acronym, so
that's true.
An initialism or you know, whatever.
We're gonna do one podcast about why every governmental agency in comics has an acronym, like literally an acronym that spells some cool word.
I think sword, they wanted shield. It to spell shield. Yeah.
Is Argus a word, though? Isn't that just like a random arrangement of letters?
I don't know.
Sure. But Inferno was basically, Inferno was pretty good for X-Men aficionados. Like, people had been following this stuff the same way that Crisis was, like, this apotheosis for anyone who'd been following the DC multiverse for however many years. This is, Crisis was the culmination of that. Well, Inferno was that for the X-Books. They'd been pretty bogged down in continuity and all these details and subplots and you know, various different developments for different characters, and it was like it had to be paid off, and Inferno was really the culmination of all that. So, you know, for me, as someone who had read all this stuff and had read the issues leading up to, because again, I didn't really read this at the time, but you know, when I started delving into the back issues of X-Men and X-Factor and New Mutants and all these series, it was clearly building to something. And Inferno as the climax to that, I thought was pretty satisfying. Now, that said, I don't know that it's my favorite event of the 80s. I think my favorite would have to be Mutant Massacre, which was a little bit more contained. It was the first X-Men crossover event, so it was just, it was really just the core titles of Uncanny, X-Factor, New Mutants. There were a couple of tie-ins. Thor had a tie-in, Daredevil, and Power Pack, believe it or not. They are by no means crucial to the storyline itself, but basically it's where the Morlocks get slaughtered. So this underground race of mutants who are too deformed and too antisocial to interact with the rest of the regular human populace and to blend in or join Xavier's school or what have you, you know, live in the sewers underneath Manhattan. And there were a lot of them. As a matter of fact, a lot more than Chris Claremont actually intended to be, because the original artist on the comics that introduced them, Paul Smith, drew way more background characters than he intended. So he was like, holy shit, we've got way too many mutants now. We need to thin the herd a little bit. And so it was intended to be a vehicle for an entirely different event that didn't see the light of day. For reasons that, again, we can get into on a different podcast, but that morphed into Mutant Massacre, which said, let's just kill all these motherfuckers. You know, they're just background characters. It gets away from the idea of mutants as this sort of exclusive minority. There's not that many of them. Now it just looks like anybody and everybody is a mutant, and they're this underground colony, and they pretty much outnumber the main, you know, primary characters in the Marvel Universe, so let's just decimate, like, all of these guys. So
Sabretooth was the big bad in that one, correct? Or
he wasn't really the big bad, but in a way, yeah, that it did elevate him because he had been introduced a few years earlier in Iron Fist of all titles, when Claremont and Byrne were the creators on that series. And so they decided, Claremont decided to bring him over into the Marauders, this new team of characters that he had invented as the architects of this mutant massacre. So he was one of the heavies in that team, which was a whole lot of characters. It was something like probably 10 different characters all introduced for this team at the same time. And they just mowed down, like, all these, you know, faceless, nameless Morlocks in the, you know, Morlock tunnels. And Sabretooth was one of those. He went on to, like, invade the mansion. And that's when the rivalry between Wolverine and Sabretooth started.
Which kind of became one of the iconic parts of X-Men lore, is sort of like that arch-nemesis dynamic between those two.
Yes, that's where it started, and it was, you know, illustrated by Alan Davis, who is like this awesome superhero artist, and, you know, Sabretooth is on this run through the mansion, I think Psylocke, you know, the focus totality of her psychic abilities, her psychic, before any of that shit, she was just a character who was, you know, supporting cast member in the X-Books. You know, she has to fend him off until the reinforcements arrive, and, you know, that's a big character-defining moment for her. You know, Wolverine gets there, they have it out, they have this great epic battle, and yeah, that was where all that started, for sure. And Sabretooth would just be built up from that point into this major big bad for Wolverine. That was also where Colossus killed Riptide, a member of the team, and it's this great, just this great series of illustrations. I think Brett Blevins did the art on that, actually, where he's just like, pray to your gods, little man, and just grabs him and crushes his spine. You know, it's totally like not what you would expect from Colossus of all characters, and it was just like one of those shit gets real moments. But yeah, that had major ramifications. It injured and took a lot of big characters off the stage for a while. It led to the formation of Excalibur. Again, it was early X-Factor stuff where they're still figuring out who they are as a team. So Mutant Massacre is kind of my favorite just because it doesn't have that major, you know, world-shaping event that happens, but it's just a good story for a lot of different characters.
And it also had the side effect of beginning what we'll get into after the break, which is what I would call the era of the crossover, which started in the 90s and has really continued on through today. Before we take that break, real quick, Russell, favorite event of the 80s?
Favorite event of the 80s, I'm going to go with Legends, just because of some of the stuff that Todd referenced earlier. It was setting up the Justice League for the post-crisis universe, and it also is the kind of the reintroduction of Wonder Woman into the DC universe proper after Crisis on Infinite Earths. Really, really great story. I highly recommend it. If you can find it, definitely read it. I was lucky enough to find an old copy of the trade of it that you really can't find anymore now. Worst... would definitely be Secret Wars too. I mean, it's close with Millennium, but I think I'm going to give the edge to Secret Wars too there for just being not only, potty training really. That's where we're going with this. Awesome. At least Millennium, I could say, was somewhat readable by comparison. So yeah, I'm just going to leave it there because that's wow. Awful.
Nick, favorite and least favorite event of the 80s?
Like Russell, I'll go with Legends as my favorite. He kind of hit everything on the head as far as what I liked about it. One of the great crimes is that it looked like we were getting set up, that it looked kind of like season 3 of Young Justice that never happened might have actually been a Legends-like storyline with the introduction of G. Gordon Godfrey and all that kind of stuff. Sad that never happened. And then least favorite, for me, it's going to be Millennium, just because of how like freaking ridiculous it was and all the stupid characters that never went anywhere that came out of it. It was terrible.
And certainly, as many great comics happened in the 80s, maybe more important comics than in any decade, that Millennium is probably the most like, oh my god, how 80s event I can think of.
Yeah.
But anyway, with that, we're going to take a very quick break. We thank you for listening and hope you come back after the break.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly from Ring of Honor Wrestling. Make sure you check out The Kevin Kelly Show each and every week. PlaceToBeNation.com. We'll be talking about wrestling in the past and wrestling today. Plus, be talking about all kinds of sports and pop culture, whatever's on your mind, too. We'll answer your questions each and every week. The Kevin Kelly Show, right here, PlaceToBeNation.com.
Let me know you in the house.
This is the king of old school, Steve Corino, and you've heard all the rumors, and it's true. The Steve Corino Show is here. We talk about wrestling. We talk about baseball, movies, television, anything you want to talk about. New guest every week. That's right, the Steve Corino Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
Hey, this is Bauer from The Bauer Show, sports and more. You can check out The Bauer Show podcast every Wednesday and Friday right here at placetobenation.com.
The Bauer Show.
Chad, do you hate it when commercials run and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on placetobenation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Hey, this is Rob Naylor. Do you still enjoy pro wrestling? Believe it or not, I still do. So you better join myself and Will on the Google Wrestling Podcast exclusively at placetobenation.com.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and... Shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on Place to Be Nation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, this sounds terrible. The Titans of Wrestling... Oh, brilliant. Sorry. The Titans of Wrestling are...
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for the show and breakdown matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover. Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Pop. We watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of Wrestling.
You know you want to hear it.
What's going on? This is the Godfather, Nate Milton, with an offer you cannot refuse. Each and every week you can join Marcus Vandenberg, Big Nasty Alfred Kunawa, and myself on the Kings of Sport podcast, available exclusively on placetobenation.com, your one-stop spot for the best in sports and pop culture.
Hey, this is Ben Morse from Marvel.com as well as the Brad and Chad Show, and I've got a new podcast. Well, I'm part of a new podcast, Place to Be Nation's Main Event. Hosted by Scott Criscolo every other week, it's a roundtable discussion with myself, Andrew Reich, Steve Willey, Jordan Duncan, and an assortment of special guests as we talk wrestling today, the big questions, and our feelings. Please, please, please check this podcast out, because if the ratings go down, I know I'm the first head on the chopping block for Justin Rosero. See you guys every other week on Place to Be Nation's Main Event.
I'm Scott Criscolo, and your new home for sports is Place to Be Nation's Extra Point. Join me and the doctor, Giorgio Bellino, for your sports hookup, whether it's NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, colleges, or the Cowboys MMA Blitz.
Forget about it. Plus, join me for my prescription where I will solve all the world's sports problems with my own brand of medicine.
That's Place to Be Nation's Extra Point here on PlaceToBeNation.com.
In Rhode Island and looking for great food and a fun atmosphere, we'll be sure to stop by Bonehead's Wing Bar, 131 Washington Street in West Warwick, with over 65 different wing sauces and dozens of sandwiches, burgers, and appetizers. In a fully stocked bar, Bonehead's has something for everyone. Bonehead's also shows every WWE and UFC pay-per-view, features live music, weekly trivia, and much, much more. So be sure to stop in, tell Matt and the crew that Police Simulation sent you, and become a Bonehead today.
What's up, wrestling fans? This is Jeff Peck, and you can check out my wrestling podcast, The Still Real to Us Show, every Saturday right here at placetobenation.com. It is a wrestling podcast from a fan's perspective, and we're not doing it in our mom's basement. So check it out every Saturday right here at placetobenation.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
And we are back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. I hope we have some kid listeners out there, maybe, to get some into the comics industry here. They won't understand.
Me too. I'm sorry about our language.
I kind of hope we don't have any kid listeners.
Yeah, that's a great point. Let me rephrase. I hope no parents will ever allow their children to listen to this podcast. It's a terrible idea, and I apologize to any parents out there who may be offended by any of our language. Actually, I'm not, because you should listen.
I profusely apologize, and kids, if you are listening, I just want to say it gets better. It really does. Like, as a comics fan, oh my God, like, you know, we were like the dorks of the planet growing up.
Yeah.
I mean, even when comics were hot in the 90s, like, you were a total, you know, bad word loser when you were growing up reading comics, even when they were a part of, you know, popular culture and during the bubble and all that stuff. Well, guess what? Now we rule the world. So It gets better. It really does.
Not to jump up on a tangent, but do we really rule the world? Because I feel like even as popular as comics and superheroes are now, it's always like more like the idea and the concept more than it is the actual act of reading comics itself.
I'm going to go ahead and say we rule the world because I just feel like the last decade of comic books in pop culture, all these comic book movies that have made multiple billions of dollars at the box office have really vindicated us. And so if I'm, you know, on the subway, not that we even have subways in the greater Richmond area where I live,
for the purpose of the metaphor, podcast, pretend that we all live in giant cities with subway stations and sprawling city
streets. Let's pretend, because that's a great visual. If I'm reading a comic on the subway, I'm going to feel superior to the person next to me who isn't reading that comic, because I'm like, yeah, you know, like, I was doing this before it was cool, and now
you've
it's
never
cool.
Never read Millennium, have you?
Or Genesis.
Unless, of course, you're reading New Guardians Annual Number 2. Which we'll discuss at a later date. And then you feel like a giant loser.
So, just yeah, leaving aside there. What you're actually reading, just the act of you've got a comic in your hands, or even if you're, like, on your iPad reading a comic through, you know, Comixology's Guided View, which is really great. But you feel pretty – I mean, me personally, I feel pretty good about it. And I'm like – you know, if people are looking over my shoulders, good for them. They can ask me questions or – maybe, you know, that's going to pique their interest, or maybe they're going to look down on me. If they look down on me, then fuck them. They're probably douchebags. So,
yes.
You know, I just feel like society has kind of vindicated.
I know we're getting way off topic, but one of the coolest things
is... passion for this. We are, yes.
One of the coolest things is my wife is a 7th grade English teacher. She teaches at a middle school here locally. And, you know, she has a pretty decent-sized library of stuff for her kids to read, because at that age... you know, 12, 13, you're trying to get them to read anything they will. And she says they don't have much interest in reading most things, but they will fight over the 6 or 7, like, graphic novels that she has in her classroom, which is just really, really cool to me, man. Like, I'm so psyched that that's a thing.
And I feel vindicated when I'm on the subway and I'm reading the comic book-sized pamphlet I've created of all of our Place to Be Nation columns, which you can find
too.
At placetobenation.com. That's placetobenation.com. Which brings us, in wonderful segue fashion, into a decade that was the age of the crossover coming out of the 80s, which is the 90s, a decade that has been maligned by many, beloved by some. I happen to have very fond memories of it because that's when I grew up, you know, reading comics. And certainly it went out of control for a while. But
yeah, isn't there kind of a line? Like, when does it happen? Like, 94, 95, like somewhere in that time frame?
96, really, because that was...
Oh, you talking about the when, like, that ended or when it
like,
started?
Like, when the 90s went from being, like... something that we can look back on now with a great deal of nostalgia and think is really awesome into something that, like, we don't want to speak of ever again.
Age of For me, it was 95, and then Onslaught was 96.
And so, yeah, 95, 96 is kind of wild, and 94, 95.
I would say, you know what, I think the big dividing line is actually the Clone Saga. I think that's a really big microcosm of event comics, of... the comic book industry, of the market bubble, of just comics as a whole, and comics fandom. I think you can trace that to the Clone Saga, which started in 94, I think, and went on. I think it's still going on now. No, it felt like it went on fucking forever.
And then there was no, like, build-up to the end of it. It just, like, it kept going at, like, a steady pace.
It landed with a thud, and that's why I say it's a microcosm,
November
because...
November of 96, I believe. I believe it was November of 96. I'm in sixth grade, and I buy the comic to see what my new favorite spider-related character, Ben Reilly, is going to do next. Oh, wow, Peter Parker's retired. It's great. And I pick it up, and not only do they kill him off, they turn him into dust.
Yep. So,
it's like
that's exactly why I say it was a great microcosm, because it started off really strong. Like, everybody was really into it. It was selling well. People were intrigued by this premise, and it kind of kept going past the point of its natural conclusion, and you're like, well, maybe we ought to, you know, tie a bow on this, but the marketing department had so much influence and was so pushing for it to keep going because it was selling like gangbusters, and people eventually lost interest, and the comics suffered, and it just got to a point.
I was 10 when it started, 12 when it ended.
I
think Russell can attest to this as well. There was a point, even when I was reading it as a kid, there was a point when it was like, it kind of feels like they're just making this up on the fly. Like, I didn't know the inner workings of comics at that time, but I remember distinctly being at a certain, I can't remember the exact point, but I was just like, I don't know, this doesn't kind of seem like they, like, it makes sense. Like, I don't really think this was what they were building to.
there was a time whenever it felt like, okay, this is a pretty interesting direction. Like, maybe we've got something really good going here. It starts to wane a little bit there in the middle, and then towards the end, it was like, oh, we actually have to write an ending for this, don't we? Oh,
yeah.
What happened was
the market collapsed and it forced them to end it. It wasn't, I mean, if comics had kept selling like they were at the height of the Clone Saga, it would have kept going. They never would have ended it. But their hand was forced because, you know, the market imploded. That bubble burst and it was like, oh shit, we're left with a situation where we have, you know, a Spider-Man who isn't Peter Parker, and we're holding the bag now, and we've got to get this behind us as quickly as possible. And they did that in the most efficient way that they could, which was just, you know, 1 month, you know, 4 issues, boom, done. Just landed like a thud. They had to put it behind them and move on. It was like, let's never speak of this again. That's like how fast that shift occurred.
Having not read the Clone Saga much of it, I've read bits and pieces here. The only bit of insight I can offer is something I always appreciated about Ultimate Spider-Man, which you guys know is very near and dear to my heart. That entire series is written for the trade, 6 to 7 issues tops for each story. When Bendis finally did his version of the Ultimate Clone Saga, 8 issues with a prelude and a postlude issue. So 10 issues compared to the standard 6 or 7. Way overstretched, even for an Ultimate series at the time.
Yeah.
I believe someone is taping a box in the background, it appears.
That is what that sounds like.
The way that the Clone Saga played out was so frustrating for me, especially because like I was one of the kids that actually bought into Ben Reilly and thought, okay, here's something different. And then it wasn't just the fact that they revealed that he wasn't the real Spider-Man after they had said that he was. It was that they revealed that he wasn't the real Spider-Man after they said he was, and then completely obliterated any trace of the character's existence. So then I was just like, God, I wasted the last 2 years of my life reading this crap.
And you know. That Ben Reilly thing was kind of an example of a larger trend, because at the same time, or not the same time, a little bit earlier, over at DC, you've got DC, you know, trying or teasing replacing major characters with, you know, a new character 3 times over, I believe. Superman, Batman, and Green Lantern coming, you know, most to mind.
Yep.
We mentioned Really? I don't remember that one as well.
That might have been after or during the Clone Saga. I can't exactly remember the timeline, but wasn't it like it was supposed to be a continuity patch, right? Like, it was one of those holdovers from Crisis, where Crisis on Infinite Earths, it created this new history and this new DC universe where all the multiverses had been streamlined into just one new Earth, basically. But that invalidated the histories of characters like, you know, Hawkman and everything that had happened in Infinity Inc., which were all like legacy characters.
Right.
Yeah, and even Wonder Woman, who was supposedly a founding member of the JSA and later Justice League, it was like, well, no, wait, she was just recently created here, you know, molded out of clay, and her history had just started with the post-Crisis DC Universe, and it was like, well, how does she have, you know, an influence and a history prior to this? And it was like, her mom replaced her, I guess, in the continuity. And
right. They patched that in at some point. To make
it was a John Byrne thing, right?
Yeah. Now, was this when they replaced her with Artemis, I believe it was?
Replaced
Wonder Woman with Artemis? Yeah, I think that was what they did. And
just to confirm, this isn't the awesome version of Artemis that was on Young Justice, correct?
Oh, no. This was a totally different but perfectly fine version of Artemis. It was totally different from the Young Justice.
This was like 96, 97, thereabouts, right?
Yeah. Well, that actually opens up a cornucopia of discussion possibilities. We talked about Marvel's kind of dividing line event that actually was on the downside of Marvel events of the 90s, but was no doubt probably their biggest event of the 90s. When it comes to DC, it seems like every character all the major characters had huge, gigantic character or landscape-changing events, crossover events in the 90s. Now, for my money, a lot of the character crossovers within the families were very good, but a lot of the big event books universe-wide were not very good. Speaking of Armageddon, mm-hmm. 2001, Zero Hour, things of that nature. Russell, you've obviously started reading the 90s as well a little bit, and you've read in hindsight tons of these through your collection that you've established. We've talked in the past about this. Talk a little bit about the the character revolution of crossovers. Batman, Superman, Green Lantern all had these huge events, and how they compared to some of the parallel events going on, like Armageddon 2001, War of the Gods, things like that, Zero Hour, Final Night, things of that nature.
Well, just like over at Marvel, DC was trying to one up the events that had been such big hits for them in the 80s. Armageddon 2001 and War of the Gods were kind of the opening salvo in all of that, but it really hit its stride in the in 1992 when they did the Death of Superman. Some people look at that event really cynically and say that it was just a ploy to get sales on a character that they thought maybe the popularity on was starting to wane a little. But the truth is, whenever you see some of the writers and artists who worked on that book and worked on coming up with that story talk about it, they get really emotional, and they poured a lot of themselves into it. And when I go back and read it now, that's what I get out of it. The Return of Superman is kind of the Return of Superman is kind of the same way. That's when a couple of times in Return, things kind of feel like they go off the rails a little with all the stuff that gets kind of packed into it, but it ends on a really nice note.
Mm-hmm.
Nightfall, I felt, was more concentrated, I guess. It seemed a little more focused on its ultimate goal, although it's kind of one of those quintessential 90s things that we were talking about during the break, with everything going extreme and everybody getting even darker than they were before. So, there's Nightfall bringing in Azrael as the new replacement Batman, and he's, over the top.
Yeah, and I always kind of felt like that was the point, here is this 90s version of Batman who's so ridiculously dark and extreme and over the top, but there's a reason why Bruce is always going to be Batman, and no one, no matter how the times change or how the generations change, will ever be able to be that. Kind of like Superman, it was the same thing. For me, with Death and Return of Superman, which is why I feel like it can be kind of frustrating for fans of Hal Jordan, because the two similar stories at the time to Emerald Twilight, Nightfall and Death and Return of Superman, in the end, those stories were all about why those characters are great and those characters can never be replaced. Whereas Emerald Twilight kind of came off as, here's why Hal Jordan needs to be thrown off to the side and isn't that big of a deal anymore. Now, granted,
you're exactly right, Nick.
In the years since, now, I wouldn't change a thing, because Geoff Johns came along and took the elements of Emerald Twilight and really turned them into a great, compelling story. But that's all with hindsight's benefit. I imagine if I would have been a fan of Hal at the time, I would have been pissed.
And they were.
So unbelievably mad.
Ron
Moore still talks about, to this day, people who would write angry letters, like so, I mean, the type of vitriol that we see on a regular basis.
Absolutely.
Now with,
and you know,
with, on the message boards, but he was getting it in letter form, so you know these folks had to have been. I mean, if you're so angry that you would sit down at a table, pad and
type
pen,
out a letter.
No, yeah. Pad and pen, write it out by hand. And send yeah. it in to him. That is a type of anger that I don't think some of these message board fanboys could ever possibly fathom.
It wasn't just message board, or you know, not message board, but letter writing fanboys.
News groups were big back then.
You know, Gerard Jones originally had a version of that story that actually went to solicit and was supposed to come out. He left the title over differences over the direction that story was going to take, which led to Ron Mars coming on.
I think Gerard actually left DC after that.
Oh, yeah, he did.
Not long after that.
I mean, and
he left everything after.
Which is really sad because...
He was not happy.
Which is really sad because the 47 issues, because I believe Emerald Twilight took place over issues 48, 49, and 50 of that Green Lantern series that relaunched in 91 or 92, the 47 issues that preceded it, all written by Gerard Jones, are among the best in that character's history. The stuff he does with Hal Jordan, like we touched on earlier, are just fantastic. And to see him, like, kind of just thrown off to the side, it's almost like a latter-day version of the J. Michael Straczynski, you know, Spider-Man deal, where this the work you've done on this character, the blood, sweat, and tears you've poured in for years, is now kind of being just marginalized because of, you know, fleeting trends in the industry, or fleeting trends in pop culture is what it seems like to me. It's just interesting to me, the comparison between Emerald Twilight and the end goal of that compared to the end goals for, you know, Bruce and Clark's respective stories.
And it's weird.
Yeah, I've never thought of that.
That's a great point.
I'm sorry to jump in, but you're right, Nick. Whereas Death of Superman, Return and Reign and all that stuff, and Nightfall and the subsequent iterations of that were all about reaffirming who Batman and Superman were. You know, this is Bruce Wayne, this is Clark Kent, this is why these are the only people who can take up this mantle. And while superficially guys like Azrael and Hank Henshaw, a.k.a. the Cyborg, are interesting as replacements, they're very short term and they're very much of the moment, and they're not going to be long term replacements, and this is why they don't work.
And with the benefit of hindsight, they come off as critiques of the kind of characters that were so popular at that time in the 90s.
I mean, like the Guy Gardner kid and Death of Superman, because I mean, Guy Gardner, granted, is a over-the-top version of what a lot of people were turning to in the 90s, but, you know, there's still a lot of Guy Gardner in a lot of the heroes and anti-heroes that were popular at that time. And so it's just an interesting...
And so, yeah, they deliberately made the kid, Mitch, in Death of Superman, be a kid who loved Guy Gardner and Russell
and thought Superman was really... Yes. Yeah, he thought Superman was really lame, yeah.
Yeah,
and it was
Russell
like,
and I have talked a lot about Funeral for a Friend, when by the end of it, you see Superman's the one, not Guy Gardner, that ends up saving this kid's family. And, and there's a scene where he visits... I believe that was in Funeral for a Friend, or maybe World Without a Superman, I can't remember exactly, where he visits the Superman monument and you see, like, holy crap, I was wrong. Like, this is what a hero is. You know?
Yeah, and so they saw that at the time, and it was like they had enough self-awareness to recognize that, you know, there are prevailing market trends, sure, but what's endured for years up to this point is what's going to persevere. So it was a great meta-commentary on what was going on in comics at the time, and to say, hey, you know, this is all well and good. We can dig down deep into these new characters and this new trend that seems to be sweeping comics of the dark and gritty and the grim and gritty and all, you know, all this stuff that was going on in the modern comics marketplace of the early 90s. But at the end of the day, what you get back to are the classic characters. Why they are so enduring.
And classic and characters have really been reinvigorated for the generation of the 90s who had started to sour on them a little bit. Like, you're showing why these guys are important and what makes them who they are, and it's just...
They got
and again, like, in hindsight, everything worked out for Hal in the end, and he's back bigger and better than ever, but... Man,
but you're right. They didn't do the same thing with Green Lantern. They really did... miss the point of the stories that Death of Superman and Nightfall were trying to tell. And when it came up for Green Lantern Stern, it was like they really did push him off to the side, and they said Hal Jordan can just be dismissed and anybody can be plugged into this role. And I say that taking nothing away from Kyle Rayner, who's a pretty cool character and you know, developed. And
but I think a lot of that, you know, what happened is the reason why they're still, and granted, it isn't the divide that there was, I think, you know, years ago, but there's still a little bit of a divide amongst Green Lantern fans with mm-hmm. Hal guys versus Kyle guys, because just of, you know,
yep.
what happened to Hal, and then Kyle coming in, being wildly successful, and now a lot of people kind of feel like he's been shoved off to the side in favor of Hal again.
Yeah, it's funny how cyclical it is, but you know, I mean, you can look at Wally West and Barry Allen on The Flash, and it's sort of the same situation where these legacy characters, you want them to move forward and be progressive, but you know, somebody always has an eye to the past, and it's just like, who wields the most influence at the time to decide, you know, who the flagship character is going to be.
Right. And I think the difference, though, and I'll let you've been trying to make a point, Russell. But I think the difference between the Barry and Wally situation and the Hal and Kyle situation is Mark Waid and Geoff Johns and the guys who wrote Wally West tended to treat Barry with a level of reverence that I felt that the Green Lantern guys didn't treat.
Barry went out on his sword. Like, he went out as the fallen hero being carried out on the shield,
right, he got
in sacrifice of the universe.
Yeah.
Hal went out as a raging maniac who was attempting to service the needs of himself above all else.
He was utterly disgraced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Russell, well, go ahead. There's one point I'd like to make to that, that DC did somewhat realize that they had really kind of shot themselves in the foot with Hal Jordan, and there was an event in 97 called The Final Night when Hal Jordan comes back as Parallax, and his internal conflict is made evident. I mean, Geoff Johns played on this a lot later, and it makes the event even vastly different read today than it was maybe when it was first running. Mm-hmm. But as Parallax, Hal Jordan has come back. I believe this is following the death of. It's not following the death of Oliver Queen, I don't think. But
it's around that time. Yeah, it's got to be pretty close.
It's close to that, but Hal is coming to the realization of what he's turned into, and he's given the opportunity to reignite the sun by sacrificing himself to destroy a Sun Eater that was at the middle of it and was going to, you know, wind up wiping out all life on Earth. So he goes out a hero in the end because he chooses to sacrifice himself and even recites the Green Lantern Oath as he's dying.
He goes out as a hero, but wasn't that 4 years after the events of Emerald Twilight with a different writer?
It was Carl Kessel who wrote that, and I think that, you know, he wanted to give Hal a more heroic moment to go out on if he was going to go out, because I mean DC had, you know, basically put it down that Kyle Rayner was going to be Green Lantern and that Hal Jordan was not going to come back, at least not just yet, and he was able to negotiate in there, hey, I want to give Hal a big, you know, heroic moment to really go out on.
Yeah.
Of course, not too long after that, he would become the Spectre.
Spectre, yeah.
Which is what, you know, this was all leading to.
That just seemed like Geoff Johns trying to get his hands on that character in any way that he could. I think Geoff Johns, from the get-go, made it clear he was a big fan of Hal and wanted to try and redeem him as much as he could, because Day of Judgment, is that it, Greg?
Day of Judgment, yeah.
Sounds right, yeah.
While it's not a great story...
Probably my least favorite Geoff Johns.
Easily my least favorite thing by Geoff Johns I've ever read. It's still
not that bad.
It still has that legacy of him planting the seeds for you know, what would become Green Lantern Rebirth, which, you know, for three of the guys on this call right now is like a seminal, iconic, like almost fandom altering story in comics.
Hal Jordan is a really interesting case study in the 90s because in Emerald Twilight, you had his downfall. You had him, like I said, becoming this disgraced hero. Someone else has to take up the mantle of Green Lantern. They consolidated all of these different titles down into just one book. So that, the age of the Green Lantern franchise is pretty much over. You know, and that manifests not only in terms of the creative side of you've got just one Green Lantern, but publishing wise, it's just one book. You know, Mosaic is gone, Green Lantern Quarterly is gone, Guy Gardner Warrior is
Warrior was still around for a little bit after that, yeah.
But
that's when he got the Voldarian powers or what? Or
the
what
alien powers, right? Yeah. So that's off in its own world. So you just have essentially one core Green Lantern, and that is now Kyle Rayner. And Hal, I mean, he's now a bad guy. He wasn't really beyond redemption necessarily until I think Zero Hour, when they realized that their big bad that they had set up for that event really wasn't cutting it. And so they brought in Hal Jordan to sort of be the pitch hitter, I guess, and to give this crossover more oomph that it didn't really have at the time. And I think that's what positioned him as ultimately a villain, not just a fallen hero, but now an out-and-out villain in the DC Universe. And it made him what I like to call kind of a radioactive character, where they'd done stuff to him that made him so far beyond the pale and beyond redeeming that you couldn't really do anything. You couldn't touch him without it, you know, you couldn't bring him back to the point that everyone had, I guess, related to or become familiar with this character. He was so far gone that it was like, okay, what do we do with this guy now? And he was sort of in this very amorphous place where you either take him in a different direction entirely or you take him off the board. And I think in Final Night, they decided we just need to retire him and take him off the board.
Absolutely. With that, guys, we're going to bring it into part one of our podcast. When we come back, though, we've got more 90s, we've got the 2000s, and we're going to get into a little bit of the mechanics of a great event and a bad event by each person's subjective criteria. I know we've got a ton more 90s events to get to. I'd really like to get into some of the kind of on-the-fly, nonsensical 90s events. Armageddon 2001, we've hinted at, but we'll get at a little bit more in depth, and then Onslaught, certainly some of the later 90s events, and then into the 2000s.
DC versus Marvel, sir.
And DC versus Marvel. But with that, we're going to bring it into this part of the conversation, and we hope you join us for part two. Thanks, guys.
Oh my God, guys. I didn't know Tim was as big into Green Lantern as we are. We can do a giant size just on Green Lantern, man. Like, that's...
I would love to.
That's some of
to.
The most fun I've had doing. Anyway, I love doing these podcasts, but that little Green Lantern discussion was like, man, that spoke to my soul right there.
I mean,
oh my God.
Yeah, really.
I haven't read a whole lot of modern Green Lantern stuff, but you know, from the 80s and from the 90s.
Oh my God, there's a random issue of Green Lantern Core from like 86, 87. It's called Pink Elephant, and it's one of my favorite things on the face of the planet. It's an issue in which it's when it's Green Lantern Core. So the team at the time is Guy Gardner, John Stewart, Hal Jordan, Chip, Salak, Aricia, and Cop Matui. And so it's a rotating team of the seven. It's a team book at the time.
Yeah.
And they're all getting ready to celebrate New Year's Eve on Earth, and Guy Gardner is pissed because nobody wants to go out and get drunk with him. And so he takes the well of the home they're living at and turns the entire water supply into, like, tasteless, odorless alcohol It's just like pure alcohol. And so, like, they're all drinking water and stuff, and they get ridiculously drunk. And this is at the time when, like, they were doing the storyline where Aresia is only, like, has the looks of, like, a 15 to 16-year-old girl.
Yeah, even though she's, like, she transformed herself.
Even though she's, like, 300 or whatever in her years.
Oh, my God, that was so wrong-headed. Yeah.
She and Hal get hammered, and, like, Hal finally just goes, you know what? I don't care. And then they have sex off-panel.
I want to read this in the worst way. You've got to...
Chip and Kimmelog are, like, leaning on each other, like, doing the stereotypical, like, cartoon, 50s cartoon, hiccuping while they're drunk. Like,
yeah.
Weeping over each other about how all of their friends and family are dead because their planets have been murdered and massacred. And Jon Stewart drunkenly proposes to Cat Matui and they agree to get married, which actually winds up happening. And it comes to reveal that, like, Salak is passed out in a corner and imagining, dreaming giant pink elephants that show up to attack them, but it's just a construct of Salak's ring that he's, like, subconsciously controlling. And they're all fighting these awesome giant pink elephants drunkenly. It's one of the best things ever. Like, my favorite issue of that little run by far. And I love that run.
That sounds like almost like a Keith Giffen or J.M. DeMatteis type
yeah
of.
Yeah, it was Englehart, but it was
okay.
Man, it was hilarious, and it was Guy Gardner you know,
got to read that.
He leaves for, like, that's, and the thing so is, Guy Gardner leaves to go get, like, party supplies or something, and when he comes back, everybody's passed out, and so then he's mad about, like, nobody drinking with him, even though he did the whole water supply thing.
Yeah.
I mean, great stuff.
He got him so slush.
Yeah.
So, speaking of Green Lantern events, before we get on to the next conversation, Russell, have you caught up on Green Lantern books?
Yes.
Did you hate the annual as much... Okay, never mind. Go ahead. We'll start with the positive.
I was going to say, Uprising has been awesome so far, I think.
Yes, it has. My God, both issues of that so far, parts one and two, are just freaking outstanding. And so I take it that you have been, you have read the latest issue of Green Lantern Corps.
No. Greg? We're talking about Guardians. Oh, wait. No, oh, Corps? Yeah, it was Sodom Yacht? Yes.
Yeah. Return of Sodom Yacht. I texted you.
I marked out
right after I read that.
Marked out for that character, I think.
And then Greg and I have both.
I had to text you right after.
Have both read the New Guardians annual and are united in our hatred, like, in terms of it might be the worst comic we've read in, like, 3 years.
It has just about reaffirmed my decision to leave that book.
It was god awful. And granted, like I knew I was going to hate the moment whenever they finally went through with it, because I hated the idea all the way up through the lead-up to it, but that didn't make me hate that Kyle and Carol kiss any less than I hated it when it finally happened.
Yeah, and
Carol Ferris?
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
And Kyle Rayner?
Yes.
Ugh.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and the thing is, like, New Guardians, like, I thought it had been kind of boring in recent months, but it was still a pretty decent book, you know? But the annual just felt like it was out of left field bad to me. Like, the art was really bad, because it wasn't high graphics or good. Like, the art, it was confusing. It was a lame character. It was like, it almost felt like a 90s book to me. I don't know how you read it, Russell. I know you said it, you didn't like it either, Russell.
And Tim, I'll kind of tell you, like, my take on the current Kyle Rayner thing right now. We mentioned earlier, like, the divide between Hal and Kyle fans.
Yeah,
it feels to me like recently they've made, it feels like they're trying to make up to Kyle fans the fact that Hal is back and is clearly the flagship again by, one, making him overpowered. They've given him the White Lantern powers, which means he can control all the emotional spectrum, not just green or red or blue or what have you.
Now they've given him a reality-altering power.
A reality. He went behind the source wall now and can rewrite reality to his basic whims or whatever. And on top of all of that,
like when Tommy became the White Ranger on Power Rangers,
yeah, it's very similar,
and just bitch slapped Jason essentially in the face,
yeah,
and then took his woman, like, as if Hal wasn't, you know, demoted enough in terms of power level. Now he's just gonna make out with his woman, and Hal's just gonna sit there and shrug and cry and masturbate in the corner.
Is it wrong that I've always kind of thought of Carol as a bit of a cougar? Like, she's okay.
That's the point. Like, to me, that's
really
the point of the character.
Oh, man.
Yeah,
Kyle's, like, in his early 20s. He's, like, 22. And Carol's, like, maybe 38, 40, you know, like,
well, not so much anymore.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, well, everybody's been de-aged, so Kyle and Hal are really not that far off in age, and neither is Carol.
That's bullshit. So, they got to be at least 10 years apart.
Well, not so much anymore, but the whole thing with New Guardians is that it started off, and the past several months it's been, you know, the issues would start off kind of meh, but then they would build up and start to get more interesting towards the end, and I'd ultimately feel like, oh, well, now I really do want to see where the story's going, only to be led to that same format pretty much every issue. And what blows my mind is that Justin Jordan is such a talented writer.
He is,
I've been reading Dead Body Road, and of course the stuff that he did with Luther Strode was just phenomenal. The guy is... you know, got some really great ideas, and I even think that he's got some good ideas for New Guardians, but I don't know, it's just, it's not working out the way that I had hoped.
New Guardians is the only one of the Lantern side books that after, you know, the post-Jeff Johns era began, has gotten worse instead of better. I think Core, even as great as Tomasi's run was, I think Core's gotten better. I think Red Lanterns has gotten immensely, insanely, like, so far above where it was better. And meanwhile, New Guardians has just become, like, a shithole. To me, like, that story of Kyle learning to master the emotional spectrum is much more interesting than Kyle running around being all-powerful and, you know...
It's like there's a good idea in there, and the execution is just not coming together. Like, I think everybody involved maybe wants it to, but...
there's a good idea in there, and it was at the end of Green Lantern 20 when we saw, like, Kyle towards the end of his life as this benevolent healer and less of a warrior. And to me, he's still embarking on generic, well, like, Lantern ring-slinging missions and not focusing on what can I do for the good of the universe with this power that makes me different than every other character.
And it really feels like, I mean, the title of the book is New Guardians, and he was supposed to be the guy that takes the Templar Guardians around the universe and lets them, you know, see things and experience things, but it really feels like they're relegated to quippy side characters.
They're so much less interesting than the old Guardians. Like,
they are.
Old Guardians, while they were douches, they were arrogant, entertaining to read douches. And these are just new, like, uninteresting hippie douches.
And like you said, Russell, the idea of it was to give these new Guardians a humanity that the old Guardians didn't have, but instead, all they do is drop one-liners and occasionally say things like, this appears curious.
It was intended, it should have been like what Gantt became during...
exactly.
It should have been what Gantt became during Hard Traveling Heroes. Like, the entire point of that was they set off on a course, you know, a course across America so that Gantt could discover humanity. And this kind of, I thought, was going to be like a galactic version of that, them learning to be one with the universe, all that kind of stuff. And instead, it's just been generic Kyle Rayner stuff. And it's just not interesting to me in any way.
Didn't we kind of already do this with Ion when...
He absorbed
the power of the central.
That's another
battery.
Thing, you know. It's been a constant struggle to find a way, because you know you have Hal, and then you have John, who obviously is relevant in his own way because he's completely different in characterization, and of course he's black. I mean, for lack of a better term, like that does set him apart in the world of comics. Then you have Guy Gardner, whose personality couldn't be any more different from Hal or John, and then you have Hal and Kyle. Who, yeah, the age difference is there, and Kyle could be a little bit more creative, and Hal's a little bit more of a maverick. But for all intents and purposes, when they're handled by writers who aren't Jeff Johns, they're essentially the same character. And so you got to kind of find a way to distinguish one from the other. And sadly, it seems like the way they've been doing that is by trying to give Kyle these godlike powers, whether it be the Ion sentience or now the White Lantern thing and the Source Wall thing.
Well, to be honest, I don't even think it's the overpowering. I do think he's way overpowered now, even though he might have had more power as Ion. It was a different DCU then, where there were more celestial characters and stuff out there. I think that the Ion series worked for me because it was Ron Mars writing it, and he knew the character really well, and it was Kyle having his own adventures with his own supporting cast and developing his own relationships and things like that. And also, by the way, things happened. In New Guardians, like Russell said earlier, it just feels like each issue is a setup. But for what, it ends up being nothing. You know, it's It just feels like it's constantly set up.
I understand that they don't want to directly follow the events of Green Lantern 20 out and not deviate from them at all. I understand that each writer who comes with a title doesn't want to be tied to what Geoff Johns did in that awesome epilogue. But that doesn't mean that everything he presented in the epilogue isn't worth at least pursuing for a little bit. I mean, we went from giving the impression that Hal and Carol were going to marry and fall in love forever to Carol yet again coming up with, like, the flimsiest logic in the world for why she and Hal can't be together.
And again, the characterization is the big thing, because Carol's reason for not being with Hal right now is, God, Hal's out in space all the time. And yet, literally, from the moment that they broke up in Robert Venditti's first issue of Green Lantern, Carol has been in space in every single issue of New Guardians except the annual. So, I still am not entirely sure what even happened in the annual, to be honest with you. It was a strange...
Something, 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 Kyle's dad, something, something, Source Wall, something.
And the new 52 version of Oblivion, I guess.
And now, my impression is the Source Wall, instead of, like, everybody who's ever touched its face and hands being imprinted in it, now it's just Kyle Rayner's face and hands all around the outside of the Source Wall is what it seems like.
I think that was just a Kyle projection of the Source Wall, but it was very strange, poorly... Again, I can't stress how bad the art was in the issue.
And it seems like it's kind of like that Thor story over in Marvel, where now Asgard is above that random town in Oklahoma. My impression is now the Source Wall is, like, wrapped around this town in New Mexico or something.
It was a strange issue.
The whole thing, by the end, I don't know if you guys picked up on this, but it really does seem like they're teasing that... we're coming to a point where they're possibly going to remove the White Lantern power from Kyle altogether, and he may wind up back as a Green.
I think if you take the White Lantern stuff
from him, you got to make him something other than a Green to set him apart. Like,
I'm kind of hoping that he is the one who's going to wind up being responsible for Blue Lantern Corps.
See, I want that to be Guy so badly that, like, I think that's the natural endpoint for the Red Lanterns thing, is that Guy is the one responsible for reinvigorating the Blues.
I just don't know that they can work that in from a character standpoint.
That feels like it would be a cool thing to see, but it feels awkward to try and make that transition with Guy. But I really feel like Guy would represent Saint Walker's own redemption if Kyle were to help him get to the point where he could become, you know, the sole Blue Lantern again, or maybe him with Kyle becoming the new Blue Lanterns, and St. Walker saying, you know, Guy really feels like he's just beyond redemption, but he's not just his own redemption, he's my salvation, I must turn him back.
If he's palling around with Carol, like you say, then maybe he's going to be the new avatar of the Pink Lanterns.
The Predator.
Star Sapphire, the Predator... What Ranger. Have you? I kind of lost track of that stuff, but it sounds like Geoff
pull the Predator out of the Source Wall first.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah, that was
Doctor Doom's in the Source Wall too. If you read X-Men Teen Titans, yeah. So.
Hey there, Nation. This show's going pretty long, so what we're going to do here is break this into two parts for you. If you're on placetobenation.com, you can go ahead and click the link right in this very post. If you're listening on iTunes, part two will start right now.